Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1-cubic-foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Story number 1. I still remember the first time I saw that family driving up to the old Victorian next door. We were a small town, mostly teachers, farmers, and old-timers like myself. I'd been the local sheriff for 11 years. Nothing I hadn't seen before. But as their rusty van groaned to a stop, the hairs on my arm stood up. There, clutching her mother's hand, was a frail little girl, her eyes unfathomable. She held a doll, not the kind you see at the church bazaar, but a grotesque ancient thing, painted lips pulled back in an overwide smile, its button eyes so black they seemed to swallow the sun. Its limbs, jointed and stiff, looked too thin, almost insect-like. I snorted at myself for being spooked by a child's toy. Days passed. Life in our cul-de-sac went on, mowing grass, feeding the hens, friendly waves to neighbors. My wife, ever the gracious one, invited the new family for supper. The girl followed, doll tucked tight to her chest. She barely ate, eyes fixed on the corner where the doll sat on a side table, staring at me. It stared even when I looked away. The first pain came at night. A sudden wrenching in my knuckles, a deep twisting in my knees, like someone trying to unscrew my bones. I chalked it up to age or an old football injury, but every night the pain crept further, dull at first, then sharp, radiating across my body in flares that left me sweating. Then I began seeing that doll. The first time I found it perched on the hallway floor, just where the moonlight slashed through the window. Nobody else was up. My wife swore she'd locked the doors. I stared at the doll's crooked grin. My stomach churned. I picked it up with a kitchen towel, heart pounding, and tossed it onto the porch. Before dawn, it was back. This time, at the foot of our bed, its face upturned in the gloom. Days bled into weeks, each one worse than the last. My nerves frayed. I'd find the doll in new places. Once, poised on my nightstand, its face a mask of knowing malice. Once in the bathroom, damp and cold. None of the windows were broken. Our doors were always locked. I questioned my wife, who insisted she hadn't seen anything. Maybe a prank, a child sneaking in, rationalizations at odds with my racing heart. The pains worsened. My hands curled involuntarily. My jaw ached until tears welled in my eyes. One night, my wife found me sobbing on the porch, blood leaking from my tear ducts, dripping onto my pajamas. The metallic taste in my mouth was thick, cloying. A doctor would later call it a spontaneous nosebleed exacerbated by stress, but I'd never seen anyone cry blood. The next morning, stains remained on my pillow. In the mirror, my eyes looked sunken, ringed with bruises. I began sleeping with the lights on, shotgun close by. I started scanning for footprints outside, evidence of trespassing, but the grass stood tall and undisturbed. My mind circled between dread and embarrassment. Still, the doll kept appearing, as though it could slip through walls. I brought it to the edge of the property and flung it into the woods. But the next night, it was back, waiting on the kitchen counter, its arms wide like it wanted a hug. A rational man would have called it a breakdown. Stress, hallucinations, maybe a hidden prankster. But logic frayed more each day. The final straw snapped on a fetid Sunday evening when I decided to confront the family. Their house was in darkness. The porch creaked beneath my boots. I rapped on the door, expecting a flustered apology or an explanation. The knob turned with no resistance, unlocked, an oddity in a part of town where folk left nothing to chance. The humidity stank of decaying wood and something sharper, like rotting meat. As I entered, the temperature seemed to drop, a clamminess in my bones unfelt even on the bleakest winter nights. The house was empty, or so I thought. As I edged into the main hallway, a chill ran through me, cold, wet, nauseating. The wallpaper was faded, peeling in spots, and from somewhere deep within, I thought I caught a faint, high giggle, barely more than the whine of wind. The smell hit me then, a stench so potent it clawed at my throat, a gut-churning chemical rot. I reeled, closing my eyes. When I opened them, I saw her, the girl, pale as parchment, standing midway down the corridor. The doll was in front of her, upright, as if it stood under its own power. Its eyes, pits of darkness, seemed filled not with mischief, but something older, hungrier. For an instant, it looked almost alive, head twitching, mouth stretching wider. My stomach turned. Then the front door banged shut, the echo vibrating up my spine. I tried to speak, to demand answers, but the words wouldn't leave my throat. Dizzy, choking, I staggered back, my vision narrowing. Before blackness took me, I remember her small hand, cold as ice, brushing my arm. I woke on my own front porch, skin prickled with dew. My shirt stuck to my chest, smeared with old blood. My wife, wild with worry, swore the new family had moved out 2 days before, their house empty save for dust. She showed me the vacant yard, bare as my memory. No van, no toys, only mud and old leaves. Even now, years later, my bones ache worst in July. The sight of dolls, porcelain, or plastic makes my scalp itch. And sometimes in dusk's half light, I fancy I see something small and grinning in the corner of my eye. Doctors called it stress, vivid dreams, or a breakdown from overwork. Maybe, but I stopped locking eyes with my own reflection after that. Stopped trusting my neighbors quite so easily. Occasionally, when the wind howls just so against the windows, the scars on my hands throb, and I swear I can smell that rancid, sugary rot. I tell myself there's always a reasonable explanation. The night is never entirely silent, but sometimes the quiet feels like someone or something trying not to be heard. Story number two. I won't ever forget the 4 days my grandfather spent in our house before he died. Back then, I tried to convince myself I was being dramatic. I kept telling myself old people get strange when they're close to the end, that the mind does things nobody can explain. But after that week, there are some moments I go back to in the middle of the night when I'm lying awake and the house creaks in just the wrong places. My mother brought him home from the nursing place because she said it'd be more comfortable for him, and I get that. Every whimper he'd make there, she'd hear over the phone and cry. The day he arrived, he seemed confused but alert, nodding in his chair, hands twisted in the blanket. His eyes kept roaming, watery and wide, not quite focusing on anyone. There was a strange film over them, milky at the edges. I kept remembering the glassy look of freshly caught fish, but felt sick thinking it. The first night I didn't sleep well. My room is farthest from his, but the old walls of the house carry sound, especially when everything else is quiet. Sometime after 2 a.m., I woke up parched, the air heavy with summer heat. I left my room. The hallway smelled thick and tired, like dust and plastic from the oxygen tubing. When I passed his door, it stood half open, which was odd just because my mother always closed it to let him rest. I should have just kept walking, but I looked. He was sitting on the edge of the bed, elbows on his knees, staring dead ahead at me, or through me. His eyes were fully clouded now, blank and pale, like he couldn't see anything at all. My scalp tingled, and I remembered stories about snakes when they're about to shed. He moved his mouth, and a dry, sinewy voice whispered my name. But it was wrong. not his nasal slur, deeper and hollow. He mumbled something else after. The syllables twisted around my ears. Not quite English, not any language I recognized. My skin prickled all over. I ducked my head, grabbed a cup of water, and went back to my room. I locked the door, the first time I'd ever done that in our house. Nothing happened until the following night, but everything felt set off kilter. My dog, Cindy, usually sprawled at my feet, refused to lie down. Sometime after midnight, she started whining, then pawing and scratching at Grandpa's door. My mom, half asleep, shuffled down the hallway and let her in, trying to calm her. I stayed in my room, but after 5 minutes, Cindy launched herself back out, yelping. She shivered so hard her collar rattled and hid under my bed, eyes wild. When I peeked in Grandpa's room, the air was thick. It smelled like mildew and salt, as if there was a puddle somewhere I couldn't see. Grandpa hadn't moved at all, but when he blinked at me, his eyes seemed blanker, smeared with white. I forced myself to say he just needed his medicine sooner. Maybe he'd had an accident. But nothing I told myself made sense of that deep, wet smell that clung to my skin. Cindy did not come out from under my bed for days. On the third morning, I tried to coax her out with treats, but she just whimpered and pressed herself tighter against the wall. I still can't figure out.
Wayfair's Labor Day clearance is here. Right now, score up to 70% off everything home, plus fast shipping on everything right to your door. Shop now through September 2nd at wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
At what she saw that scared her so much. After that, every night had the tension of a tuned wire. I fell asleep only with my earbuds in, trying to drown it all out. But even music couldn't keep out the house's subtle changes. The air always a little too sticky, a faint tremor in the windows I didn't remember before. On the fourth night, I sat with my phone in bed, scrolling, unable to rest. At exactly 1:47 a.m., as if the house itself exhaled, all the lights flickered once. Every bulb, a flat, sick yellow surging in the walls. The TV in the living room shuddered, then turned itself on. Static hiss leaking out into the silence. Then I heard it. From his room, a moan, drawn out and hoarse, mixing with another, higher-pitched keen, like two people were making the same agony together. It was Grandpa's voice, but fractured, overlapping with something lower, rasping words I've never heard. Sharp, cutting syllables. Then a sobbing, so broken it clawed right under my skin. I curled up in bed, blankets pressed to my ears. The lights steadied and all went quiet. Morning came. The house was muggy, airless. Cindy didn't move when I got up. I went to check on Grandpa. Part dread, part responsibility. The door was ajar, but I wish I'd never opened it the rest of the way. He lay on the bed, eyes wide, glazed as though still trying to focus on something trailing across the ceiling. His mouth was gaping, crusted, packed full of dark earth. His lips had dirt ground into the creases, and there were crumbs of backyard mulch at the corners of his mouth. The stench hit me, thick and mineral, like the backyard after rain, but sharper, corrupted. I saw muddy footprints, bare, pressed into the pale carpet around the bed and over toward the door. My hands shook as I realized the mud was the same as what clung to our flower bed out back. Not grave dirt, not sand. Our flower bed, where I'd planted petunias 2 weeks before. When the paramedics and coroner arrived, nobody said anything about the dirt, at least not to me. My mom began dousing the house in holy water and threw out every set of sheets, called the priest, and told anyone who would listen that old age makes people act in ways you can't predict. I try to make jokes about it sometimes, about how families cope with death, or about crazy old men. But the smell of wet earth is different now. I can't weed the flower bed anymore without goosebumps. Once or twice since, I've woken up to a faint, wet smell and caught flickers in the hallway, like shapes pressed in fog. I tell myself it was all medical, the confusion in voices, the hallucinations, even the footprints. Maybe someone tracked dirt in that night. Maybe. Still, I've started double-checking all the locks, every night, just in case the ground brings things back that don't belong. Story number 3, I grew up with the kind of faith that made ordinary things feel heavier. God was in every lesson, every blessing over dinner, every smile from my mother. My dad was a construction foreman, hard hands, kind eyes, even if work sometimes made him gruff. I didn't expect anything supernatural to disturb us, not in Bridgeport, not in our dull, blue-carpeted living room. Everything started that January. I remember noticing it first on a Saturday when Dad got home late. He was muttering under his breath, low and heated, as if arguing with someone invisible. I recognized his voice, then another, a voice pitched wrong, a growl that scraped at the ends of words. His hands shook, hard enough that a glass tipped, water sliding across the table toward the Bible my mom kept open at all times. Suddenly, little things became obvious. Mom vacuumed 3 times a day, scattered crucifixes in corners. Dad's temper sparked over nothing. He would slam cabinets with such violence the hinges popped. But then he'd stare at his hands, quiet, shivering. At sunset, weird conversations echoed from the bathroom, as if 2 or 3 people argued in there, with only 1 set of feet visible beneath the door. Mom called in our priest, Father Hayes. She gathered her church women and their formidable casserole armies, and they stood in a nervous cluster near the fireplace. I remember the sickly sweet smell of lilies mixing with the stinging reek of the cheap holy water. Their voices trembled as they began prayers, Latin and English, overlapping and anxious. I was too scared to be in the room. I stood at the edge of the hallway, near the bottom of the stairs, heart thundering so loud I heard it in my ears. The moment they started, something in the house changed. Air shifted, cold and stale, pricking my skin. Breath steamed before my lips. The thermostat read 72 degrees Fahrenheit, but frost laced the windows. Then the power flickered. Not just a blink, the electric light seemed to pull itself thin, stretched out, and then snapped back alive. Chandelier shadows crawled up the walls, contorting faces from family photos into grimaces. Sometimes the bulbs glared so harsh, my eyes ached and burned. Other times I was blind, suffocated in near darkness. Through it all, the chanting went on. Dad started to shout, high-pitched at first, like he'd scalded himself. The howls turned deep, guttural, angry, yet not quite like him. I could hear that voice I recognized, and then another, like a broken radio refusing to tune right. Prayers grew louder to drown him out. Furniture rattled. The air seemed damp, almost oily. But amidst all this chaos, something else happened. I blinked, rubbing my eyes, and then noticed a shape at the end of the hall, half lit by the stairwell's sliver of light. I saw what I thought was a man, incredibly tall, maybe 6.5 feet, built like a lamppost. He wore a wide-brimmed hat, more like a shadow of a fedora, and a cloak so dark it seemed to swallow up the hall light around it. He stood stock still, arms glued to his thighs with no face. There wasn't any sense of flesh, just a black, faceless oval that drank in all color. He was so motionless it was like a photograph or a painted shape on a wall. Despite that, terror flooded me. I could neither shout nor breathe. I tried to look away, but my eyes returned, compelled. I heard my dad's voice splinter. His pain made me want to go to him, but I couldn't step forward. The figure's attention, if it had awareness, felt pointed like a knife, fixed on me, not the ritual raging behind the door. I blinked hard, 2 or 3 times. Then he was gone. The hallway was empty except for my shadow, flickering uncertainly with the shell-shocked light. Fear crawled in my bones and I pressed my back against the wall, deliberately avoiding any dark corners or open doors. The noises died out as prayers faded. After what felt like hours, but might have been less than 20 minutes, the temperature snapped back. The bulbs glowed steady yellow once more. My mom's church friends shuffled out, silent, eyes wide and glassy. Dad slumped to the floor, sobbing quietly, brow sweating but peaceful. The priest blessed the room again and quietly told my mother to keep the house bright and play hymns for a week. I never told anyone about the Hat Man. I should have. But every time I tried to put it to words, my tongue flattened and my chest tightened. Nobody would believe me. The closest anyone came was Father Hayes, who touched my arm with a look of suppressed fear and told me quietly, almost offhand, that I should never hunt for faces in dark corners during prayers. My skin prickled at that, and I understood more than I wanted to. Life went on. Dad stopped muttering. He was quieter, thinner, and never sat in the living room without every light on. Mom forbid anyone from skipping church. I would sometimes catch in the late hours the faint impression of movement in the doorway or a shape behind the open banister. I tried to rationalize it, shadows, anxiety, memories worming their way into late-night glimpses. Sometimes I'd reason with myself. Couldn't it have been my mind, shaken by stress, a shadow shaped by passing headlights? I combed through the possibilities. Maybe the cold was the old furnace breaking. Maybe the lights were bad wiring. But the sensation, that animal panic, the certainty that something intelligent watched, still creeps up my spine if I so much as glance at a dark threshold. I haven't seen the shape in years, yet every night I flick on the hallway light before bed and leave it burning until sunrise. And when I catch a shimmer of dark pulled in a corner, when my mind whispers that someone could be standing there, silent, staring, I don't look too long. I tell myself there's nothing, but I'm not sure I'll ever fully, truly believe that. Story number 4. My mother never spoke about Grandma except in clipped, nervous phrases. She always seemed to look over her shoulder as if voices floated just beyond her reach, rippling the air. I dismissed it, as one does. Families are full of old wounds and secrets, and every house has its shadows. But recently, sorting through the last of Mom's boxes after her passing, I found a brittle brown envelope containing a single sheet, a timeline, scrawled in my mother's unsteady hand, with words like attic and something in the wall circled again and again. Grandma's house was a mellowed, crumbling thing, still owned by distant uncles, but long abandoned. It drew my curiosity, almost a compulsion. I decided to visit one misty October afternoon, perhaps out of morbid tribute, perhaps because that singular line, something in the walls, itched at the edge of my understanding. Time had huddled in the corners of the house, dust thick as moss, warped wooden floorboards groaning beneath every footstep. It smelled sharply of old onions and mold, a sourness layered under the sweeter odor of withered marigolds. Sunlight leaking through torn curtains made odd patterns, a pattern that seemed to shift when I stepped on a creaky tile by the kitchen. I half expected an animal scuttling sounds, maybe a mouse, but there was nothing in the silence except the echo of my own heart. I followed the corridor, boots stirring forgotten doll parts and scraps of newspaper. I found myself at the foot of the attic stairs. Cold air seeped down, smelling like iron and rot. I remembered the stories, my grandmother's sleepwalking, the humming, the scratching. Years later, traces of her scraped nails might still mark the beams. I placed my hand on the banister. No one was here, I reminded myself. Just empty rooms, cobwebs. Still, my skin prickled, the fine hairs rising along my arms as if some frequency hummed at the edge of hearing. The steps protested as I climbed. At the top, the attic door gaped open, faintly pulsing with late afternoon red light from a window, broken and rimmed with dead flies. Something buzzed around my ears, an insect or maybe just a trick of nerves. The air was thick and suffocating, full of a sweetness that made me gag, like overripe fruit mixed with copper. I stepped inside. There were long grooves clawed into the plaster, some layered over with fine black mold, others fresher, bizarrely out of step with the house's decay. A faint smudge, dark brown, traced down to the floorboards. It could have been old varnish, dried blood. Who could tell? At my feet, a little pile of pinkish threads, almost like unraveled cloth, but softer. Human, I realized after a moment, a tangle of hair or something worse. I shivered so hard my teeth clicked. The window's reflection caught my eye. Not my own face, but the play of shifting light on the pale ceiling above me. For a moment, it looked like a shadow twisting, as if something chained there flexed in slow motion. I told myself it was only clouds, only the branch movement outside, except the day was still and nothing cast that shape. I thought of Grandma, clawing at plaster, humming in the corridor. I strained my ears and, somewhere behind me, a note floated up, so faint that it could have been the wind, but deliberate, oscillating in a pattern, tuneless, relentless. I felt my mouth go bone dry. It crawled up my spine, vibrating my thoughts loose. That humming wasn't old air ducts. I would have put the sound to a radio, but there was no power in the house anymore. I smelled something metallic and sharp, mingled with something sickly sweet, fermented like rot. I looked down and saw a single drop of something wet and rust-colored, darkening the wood beneath one of the gouged patches. Instinctively, I stepped back, already tasting bile. Was it so strange after all? Houses hold on to history in ways we don't fully understand. Maybe the mind fills in blanks, exaggerates quiet horror with the weight of expectation. Or maybe, as I traced the grooves with my trembling fingers, the house remembered in ways that left marks. Even so, the faint impression of nails scraping in a desperate rhythm, round and round a patch of wall, felt far too real for mere suggestion. I pressed my ear to the wall, half mocking my own fear. I heard a scuttling, not from rats or insects, but the subtle clicking of fingernails, rapping with a growing urgency, then softening into a thud. My entire body throbbed, heart leaping up my throat, leaving me boneless and cold. I forced myself down the stairs, but as I did, a flutter of red light seemed to chase me. No source, just a flash in my peripheral vision, tinged almost with a faint human wail. I sank onto a kitchen chair, clutching the lip of the table, fighting off the image of my grandmother, eyes hollow, lips parted in scream, as she'd been described. I remembered the story, the attic, the red light, Grandma's floating body, her sister's trembling terror, the way sound could shatter glass. I tried to rationalize. The old house amplified something within me. Old fears, layered guilt. Maybe I'd inhaled mold, or the wind, or some rare light effect. Even now, I clung to the idea that everything could be explained. It was only when I shut the front door behind me that I heard the faintest humming from the attic, trailing down the stairwell. It lingered in the shape of silence, vibrating in my ribs, impossibly low and constant. Even on the street, long after I left, it clung to my memory. The taste of metal, the restless prickle on my arms, that bruised red light flickering behind my eyes. Was it grief, or suggestion, or something embedded deeper in the place where family secrets settle? I cannot say. But sometimes when dust settles and the world is quiet, I hum the tune under my breath, unwilling, uncertain, as if tapping out a warning in an old forgotten code. And somewhere inside, a part of me still listens for an answer. Story number 5. I remember the night clear as cold glass, crisp with the sort of anticipation that only adolescence brings. Our neighbor's house was always a quiet one, but that evening, an odd hush pressed down on the street. My mother whispered to my father about some incident, her voice an urgent flutter, while I listened from the next room, straining every muscle to catch the words, possession, exorcism, the priest from the city. The details fizzed in my mind with a youthful, morbid curiosity. I needed to see. None of my friends dared follow, so I went alone, slipping out in the dusk. The house sat at the end of our lane, a squat old thing with battered windows. Candles glowed dimly through the glass, bending the shadows into odd, shifting shapes. My heart was a drum as I crept up to an unlit window, and careful as a stray cat, peered inside. The living room was transformed. Where furniture usually sat, waxy stubs crowded the tables and sills, snuffing out the softness of electric light. The smell, a cocktail of burnt candle, something sharp and iron, gusted out through a crack in the sill. My breath made a mist on the pane when I saw the white circle scrawled on the floor, ringed by careful red crosses. All normality had receded before this primitive, careful geometry. At the center, a man writhed. I recognized him, Mr. Henderson, always polite, always smiling, but now a crust of sweat lacquered his face, his mouth forced open in a frozen scream. The priest, unfamiliar and tall, stood over him with a strange pointed stick. It seemed too thin, and the tip caught the golden candlelight like a needle. The priest's mouth moved urgently, guttural syllables I could not place, and shadows seemed to lean closer wherever he stood. Suddenly, he jabbed the pointed stick into Henderson, but not into meaty flesh. Each puncture followed a slow, hateful circle on Mr. Henderson's skin, in odd places, the crook of his elbow, the hollow of his throat. Blackness bubbled out, not liquid like blood, not quite mist, but something thicker, bleeding into the candle flame and making it shudder. The sight made my stomach heave. Skin shouldn't spill that color. I should have turned away, but I was cemented to the ground, a horrid spectator. The priest's face stayed slack, eyes heavy with something inhuman. No blink, no flinch. Even as he pressed the stick to Mr. Henderson's eyelid and slowly, almost methodically, slid it past the lashes. What wormed out next was sticky and dark, neither blood nor shadow, but like old oil poured into water. Mr. Henderson's scream was shrill, animal, then wet and slipping. No one in the house, no one in the world came to help. Then the priest's head snapped up, gaze roving the walls. His eyes found mine where I trembled in the darkness. For 10 seconds, a lifetime, he just stared, expression smooth and unreadable. I was certain he saw me, somehow, even through the muddy window, and certainty tastes like metal, cold and stubborn in your blood. I ran, blundering into the lamplight, lungs dragging gulps of air. That night, no sleep welcomed me. Instead, images flickered in my mind. The candle glow, the needle, the blackness, that unblinking stare. The next morning, I checked everything I could. I scoured the internet for exorcisms, demonology, rituals old and new. What I'd seen, the stick, the symbols, the darkness, none of it matched any exorcism video, no matter how staged or theatrical. Every priest in every photo wielded crosses, prayer books, not needles or pointed sticks. I doubted myself, replayed the images. Surely I'd missed something, but the horror of the memory scuffed at the edge of reason. By noon, I learned another detail. The priest had vanished overnight. No one saw him leave or arrive. Mr. Henderson didn't survive. He died before dawn. His family was a fortress of stunned silence, moving through the days as if underwater, pale as wax. The only word the priest left, a sliver of comfort, was that the demon had taken the soul. Most neighbors muttered that it was God's plan or fate, but my mother just shook her head, eyes wide as if resigned only to the silence left behind. Over the next few months, the house went still and unlived in. Sometimes I dream of the room again, the candle wax crusted on old floorboards, the white circle, the stick. Even waking up, I sense that stick in the back of my mind, a presence, a line drawn in the dark. 7 months later, the news spilled through the city like black ink. The so-called priest, his photo grainy, blurred by age, had been tracked down. Except he wasn't a priest at all, but a wanted serial killer in disguise. His signature, authorities disclosed, was to pluck the eyes from his victims, keeping them as a grisly memento. The ritual, the symbols, the priestly robes, it was a mask. The survivors, his so-called exorcisms, might all have been elaborate theater for the violence he was enacting. I found myself replaying what I'd seen, trying to shoehorn it into reason. Had Mr. Henderson died of terror and shock? Was the blackness just pooling blood, optical tricks by candlelight? The stick, perhaps a custom blade designed for his ritual. My mind made lists, the mind's talent for seeing horror where there is only cruelty and fraud. Yet something hung back, a detail that logic could not mold. The stick, the blackness that did not drip like any blood I've ever seen. The unbroken gaze from the priest through glass and dusk. Sometimes in the half-light before sleep, I see that room again. The stick, the candles, the line where reality buckled. Logic scrapes away at my memories, but the questions remain, stubborn and cold, as if some fragment of what I saw, or thought I saw, waits there still, flickering behind closed eyes, refusing to let me leave those shadows entirely behind. Story number 6. Years have passed, but it's strange how memory doesn't soften the sharper edges of fear. In fact, sometimes it grows keener the more you try to dull it. This happened when I was 16, at St. Josiah's Residential, an old boarding school set in the hills, quiet and gray with the usual ghosts of history that haunt every American war that had taken place back then. I think that's what I tell myself anyway. that places get reputations and that colors the mind. I want to lay the facts down plainly as they happened to me, so I can be sure which details are real and which are the mind's embellishments. It was supposed to be a normal Friday, the quarterly movie night, when the common room's blue sofas seeped with the smell of popcorn, mosquito repellent, and adolescent disappointment. At some point halfway through the film, one of my classmates, Leo, excused himself to use the restroom, a quick nod to the prefect on patrol. Then he slipped out quietly. We didn't think much of it. The film ended, the lights snapped on, and we all staggered out into the hallway. That's when I noticed he hadn't come back. His seat was cold, the popcorn untouched. It was over an hour. I remember time stretching in strange, slack shapes as people noticed. The prefect started to look anxious. The teacher in charge, Mr. Woods, tried his number. Phone left behind, obviously. A few of us muttered about how he might have tried to sneak to the canteen for snacks, but it was a half-hearted theory, easily dissolved. I was more uneasy than I like to admit, because Leo wasn't the sort to break rules. Bored, perhaps, but never reckless. I ended up tagging along with Mr. Woods, who decided to do a sweep through the eastern bathroom block. That part of the school always made me uncomfortable. The tiles were always damp, even during summer, and the old cisterns gurgled with a sound like distant sobbing. As we entered, the corridor bulbs flickered, throwing fat green shadows across the walls. Something in the wiring, Mr. Woods had always insisted, and yet the green tinge always seemed unnatural. The door to the last stall was slightly ajar, but the reek of urine was sharper than usual, acidic enough to sting the back of my throat. I remember holding my breath. There, huddled in the far corner, knees drawn to his chest, was Leo. He was shaking, slack-jawed, foaming slightly at the mouth. His eyes rolled back until only the milky whites were showing. It felt too cold for the season as I stood there rooted, watching Mr. Woods lunge forward. The teacher's hands shook as he called Leo's name, voice echoing off tile and nothing else. Then something happened that I still can't make sense of. Leo's hand shot out, lightning fast, and clamped around Mr. Wood's wrist. The grip, later the teacher would say, felt impossibly strong, like steel wires pulled tight. The boy's eyes focused, pupils impossibly wide, and his breathing became guttural, animal. When he spoke, it was in a hoarse, strangled rasp, wholly unlike his ordinary voice. What he said made little sense. Words half swallowed, fragments of Latin maybe, or just the mind's paranoia, grafting ancient curses to adolescent mumbling. I remember his nails, blue and rough-edged, biting so deep into Mr. Wood's skin that later I counted four distinct, purpling welts across the wrist. It wasn't a seizure. I'd seen those in biology class. This was different, deliberate, aware, and suffocatingly angry. It took several minutes, but eventually Leo's grip loosened. He slumped back, limp as a rag doll. Mr. Woods backed away, sweating and pale, and others, summoned by my panicked shouts, crowded the doorway with nervous chatter. I watched as Ronit was half carried out, his skin beaded with cold sweat, face vacant. The next morning, Mr. Woods returned wearing long sleeves despite the heat. When another student asked, he showed us the bruises, scabbed, deep, dark as ink. Leo, meanwhile, stared at us with blank confusion. He had no recollection. Not of movie night, not of leaving his seat, nothing of the bathroom at all. He claimed he'd been in the common room the whole time, but everyone had seen him leave. Rumors spread, demon possession, epilepsy, drugs. The hostel warden tried to put the matter to rest, but something about the whole affair felt unsettled, unfinished. Someone, one of the younger boys, noticed something even stranger later that week. On Leo's walls and bed frame were scratchings, carved deeply enough to expose the wood beneath. Symbols, childish but frenetic, scrawled words, demon, devil, Satan, scattered in uneven patterns. It looked almost like desperate graffiti, but the marks were fresh, sticky with a faint trace of rust as if blood, not paint, had been used. Nobody confessed to it, least of all Leo, who appeared genuinely terrified and bewildered by the scene. After that, I did everything I could to avoid him. But sometimes, walking past his door at night, I'd see a faint glow filtering from the gap, not the harsh white of the tube lights used everywhere else, but a sickly luminescent green, pulsing softly as if with some hidden heartbeat. I never had the courage to peek inside. I told myself that maybe he'd smuggled in some LED gadgets, or that it was trick of the light reflecting off his posters. Yet the green was never warm, never inviting. It made the corridor feel colder than it was, made the hairs on my arms prickle. Footsteps would echo too loudly outside his door. A whistling draft would snake in, even on windless nights, as if the room were breathing. Once I watched as startled beetles scuttled away from his threshold in perfect, panicked lines, pressing their bodies flat as though afraid to be noticed. No official explanation was ever given for the marks on his arm or the lapse in his memory. Ronit finished the year in obscurity, quieter than before, then later transferred out. The stains on his wall never really faded, no matter how hard the cleaners tried. Today, as an adult, I offer myself reasons. Maybe it was stress, or a fugue state, or a prank gone too far. Maybe there was mold in the walls, or something else affecting us all. But there was a presence in those moments that I cannot name. Some nights, when I wake up to the humming green glow of my phone charger, heart beating too fast, I find myself remembering the chill and the limp hand, and that bottomless, beseeching stare. I've never quite managed to convince myself that it was all in my head. Story number 7. I moved into my new apartment at the start of spring, 3 floors up in an old yellowed building at the edge of the city. It was cheaper than the surrounding listings, probably because of its age. The paint peeled at the edges of the walls and the floors creaked, but I told myself it had character. For the first few months, nothing seemed amiss. I unpacked books, hung prints, set up lamps, and chalked up the odd sounds at night to the old pipes. I held a housewarming party for a couple of friends. They joked the place looked like something from a noir film, but I felt comfortable. I even started to think of it as home. That changed after a few quiet weeks. At first, it was just the cold. I remember sitting at my desk, my fingers numbing for no reason, even though spring sun spilled across my room. The heat was working, and if I moved across the room, the coldness vanished. The sensation was like passing right through an invisible curtain, a pocket of air that didn't belong. A few days later, I noticed water puddles near the corners. At first, I thought it might be my own carelessness, tracked in from my shoes after walking in the rain. But the puddles were inside, often around the entryway to my bedroom or pooling near windows long closed. I checked for leaks. Nothing. The plumber, called more out of impatience than worry, shrugged and assured me all was fine. Nights grew restless. I started to hear the unmistakable sound of dishes shattering, always around 3 in the morning. I would jolt awake, bracing myself for the mess and expense in the kitchen. But when I got there, every plate and glass would be unbroken, stacked as I'd left them. I began suspecting that the sounds belonged to the neighbors, maybe thin walls muffled by distance. But no one else ever seemed to be awake at those hours, and the sound was always so sharp, like it was inside my own skull. The lights began to flicker then, starting slow. I replaced bulbs. I called in an electrician, and he clucked over the wiring, told me it was sturdy, a little old-fashioned but safe. Still, the flickering continued, but only when I was alone late at night. The bulbs would buzz, their glow stuttering, throwing shadows around the ceiling like crawling fingers. My friends laughed it off the one time I mentioned it, calling it old house quirks. But discomfort started to settle into my bones. One night stands out above all the rest. The air that evening tasted metallic, heavy. I went to bed restless. It was just past midnight when I felt something jostle me. At first, it was a gentle pressure at the back of my skull, as if someone pressed a cold, steady hand there. Then suddenly my head jerked, side to side, first slowly, then rapidly, so violently my teeth rattled. Panic lit through me, and I woke drenched in clammy sweat. I was staring at the closet. Its door was half open, a black slash in the darkness. I always kept it locked. The air around me reeked faintly of stagnant water. My chest tightened. I turned on the lamp, bathing the room in weak orange light. My gaze swept the room. Nothing under the bed, nothing in the closet but old shoes and winter coats. Nothing outside the window except the weak glow of a distant streetlight. I told myself it was a nightmare, the shaking a trick of my own nerves, maybe. Still, I propped the closet door open and left the light on for the rest of the night. I tried to be rational. I bought a dehumidifier. I taped the closet lock at night, double-checked the kitchenware, and kept a small lamp burning. None of it helped. The sense of unwelcomeness grew, subtle and pervasive, a prickle at the edge of hearing, the shift in air as if someone passed by behind me as I worked or got ready for bed. Sometimes, when turning a corner, I'd catch a flash in the mirror, my own face pale and startled, but for a split second, with eyes far too dark. The final night pushed me past the point of explanations. I went to bed around midnight, lights off, phone set to silent. I dreamt of nothing, or maybe everything. It's hard to remember, but when I opened my eyes again, I wasn't in my bed. I was standing on the balcony on the top floor of the building. I'd never been there before. The railing dug into my palms. The city sprawled black and silent beneath me. The night was windless, the kind of silence that presses on the lungs. For the shortest, sharpest moment, I felt nothing. Not fear, not confusion, just a blank, cold sense of absence. Then awareness came crashing in. My toes curled over the edge of the concrete. I was inches from toppling over. Every tiny hair on my arms rose with terror. I stepped back so fast I almost lost my balance for real, then ran down the stairs to my apartment, shaken so badly I could barely turn the key in the lock. Everything else was normal. The hallway lights, the night air, the closed door to my own apartment. But I didn't sleep. I packed a bag that morning and left the apartment for good. Looking back, even now, I can reason it away. Maybe I was sleepwalking. Maybe it was stress, or a reaction to all the little things, the noise, the cold, the puddles, mounting up and festering in my mind. But sometimes, on sleepless nights, I remember hands at the back of my head, guiding, pushing. I remember that sudden sense, on the balcony, of belonging nowhere in my own life. The old apartment stands. Someone else lives there now. But I still wonder if I left something behind, or if something, long before me, never truly left at all.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.